are listening to the Live Fix Podcast, the podcast that explores the concert fan experience. We believe live music is life-altering. Join us as we share stories and connect with concert fans to discover how live music forever rocks our world before, during, and after the show. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the episode. While Live Fix Podcast is usually suitable for all audiences, this episode contains content that may be alarming to some listeners and includes references to death, traumatic events, and other sensitive content. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, live music fans. Have you ever wondered how safe you are at a show? Or are concert tragedies like the 2003 Station nightclub fire avoidable? How do concert fans emotionally recover in the aftermath of these traumatic live music events? And how can live music fans be more protected and vigilant before and during a show? On this episode of Live Fix Podcast, we dive into the tragic Station Club night fire that occurred in Rhode Island in 2003 and claimed the lives of 100 concert fans and left permanent scars on the local community. Join us as we explore the impact and lessons learned from this terrible event with special guest John Berrylick, attorney and author of The Killer Show, The Station Nightclub Fire, America's Deadliest Rock Concert. Before we dive in, please join us in a moment of silence as we remember the lives of our fellow concert fans that were killed in the Station nightclub fire. John, how are you? Thank you so much for
Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Colleen. Good to be here.
Yeah, we have we've been really excited and looking forward to having you here to talk about your book and really the the super important topic that you dive into, the impact that the concert experience that you covered. So again, thank you so much. And if you could start off by telling us what led you to begin writing the book. I know as a lawyer, practicing in Rhode Island, I assume you'd been to some shows. I know we'd asked you about some shows that you've been to before, but what led you to want to write the book?
As both a music fan and an attorney involved in the civil suits that flowed from the fire, I came to believe that after about 6 years working on the case that I and my colleagues probably knew more at that point about the details of the event and the people involved than anyone. And if it wasn't somehow memorialized, if it wasn't committed to paper, a lot of this would be forgotten. So I kind of took it on myself to try to produce what I hoped would be the definitive work on the event. And so far, it seems to have proven to be.
And when writing this book, what was the most challenging part? I know you have obviously victims that you have to worry and be concerned about, how they're feeling. And there's the whole legal aspect and obviously the horrific tragedy that happened and details of that. What part was the hardest to write about?
Well, Colleen, right off the bat, you mentioned two of the most challenging aspects, and that is that the Station fire family, the survivors and the injured, and the families of those 100 people who lost their lives are understandably sensitive about anyone who writes or talks about this event. And the very last thing we and I wanted to be seen as was exploiting this group and the tragedy in any way. So I had to be very careful in my interviews of people and writing about people to remain respectful while still telling both sides of the story, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around here and one can't shrink from it. That said, and this goes into the second thing you pointed out, legally, we're writing about living people. And I had to be very, very careful that I candidly would not be sued for anything I wrote. And that gave rise to what looks tedious. It's 600 endnotes in the book, so that anybody who may not like how they're presented in the book can look to an endnote and see its source. And their attorney can see its source. And to date, I've had you know, it's been 10 years since publication and not a murmur about legal action.
Wow. So I guess that that shows
you
that
you're very well then.
You're very very, very thorough on that. I guess, yeah, that would be something I would be concerned about, being in your position, you know, writing about such a complex situation, you know, that full of potential landmines, you know, full of potential, like you said, you know, lawsuits upon lawsuits, let alone what actually happened. I mean, there were multiple things that were happening there, you know, that were illegal or, you know, had to be, you know, investigated and all that kind of stuff. And I think that was one of the things, this multi-layer effect of the story that you were telling, I think was so compelling, let alone like all that was involved and how the fans were impacted and the community was impacted, you know, in the book. Again, the, you know, name of the book is Killer Show, and the way you've written it, it definitely has a feel as a, you know, you're laying out this court case, right? And you're laying out also the stories of the fans. And I really loved how you set things up, you know, as you know, the facts and this, but then you blend in the stories,
the personal element
of the fans, right? Mm-hmm. And that's you know, and that's what we get into a lot on the show here. But I wanted to ask you what templates or what, you know, what other books or stories that you read helped guide you to do that, because this is not obviously not an easy topic to write about, let alone do it, you know, through the lens of a, you know, potential, you know, legal backlash or
and you also did, you know, such a good way, good process of the timeline of everything, because right. You have these victims and kind of them getting ready and prepared and excited about the show, the before the show, you know, obviously then during, but then there's like a string going on with the legal issues and the history of the club. So you just did an amazing job of laying it all out.
Thank you. It was made easy in some respects because it was such a big event in Rhode Island. Rhode Island being so small, you know, they say there are 3 or 4 degrees of separation between people in most states. In Rhode Island, it's kind of 2 degrees of separation. So everyone either knew someone or knew someone who knew someone who was related to a station fire victim. Okay, so it made it very easy to research and do interviews. There were hundreds of interviews transcribed by the Attorney General in doing the criminal investigations in this. So it was a real gold mine for research. You asked about other literary works that gave some inspiration about format and organization. Mm-hmm. And I will confess, I loved A Perfect Storm by Younger. And one thing I borrowed shamelessly from that was interspersing what I'll call lesson chapters with actual plot chapters. And by that, I mean, if you had a book that was the sequence of the fire, minute to minute to minute, without let up, your stomach almost can't take it because it remains knotted too long. But if after 2 fire chapters, you back out and have a lesson chapter on fire science, or you back out and have a lesson chapter on burn medicine, or on testing of building materials for their flammability, not only can people learn some valuable stuff, but it gives the reader a little breather. So I saw that in A Perfect Storm, and I actually broke down the organization of that book and thought, boy, if I can do half as well as he did in that, it was what I was shooting for.
Yeah, that's awesome, because that actually leads into the next question. When we look at the live concert experience, we break it down into like 3 main areas: before the concert, during the concert, and after the concert. And we believe that the concert experience is not just what you do at the stage, but is that, you know, these three components, you know, there's this journey experience that's happening, and we break it into those three. And I was looking at, you know, the station fire situation through that lens. And when I looked at it, I saw the before, and the before was made up of so many of these decisions, or lack of decisions, I guess you could say, you know, made by the venue owners, made by the band, made by fans, that just turned this into this, I guess, like you were saying, this perfect storm for this terrible event. And then during was like about the actions. You know, there were things that happened in the moment, actions that happened or didn't happen, the security guard not letting people out, you know, people positioning themselves and
people still listening to the music and playing different, yeah, music. They were kind of started,
you know, they didn't know what was happening in those 90 seconds, right? Like it was like, what do we do? You know, is this part of the show? You know, or is this, is my life in danger? You know, so there's all this thought process. And then the after part is, you know, the pointing the fingers, you know, the grief, obviously, you know, the death, the imagine, you know, the emotions, you know, all the things that had to happen and who had to be held responsible, you know, for that. So I don't know if you could speak to any one of those areas, because you get into all of those areas and it just seemed like, you know, when fans are considering going to a show, there's all these decisions that they have to make, right? There was that one moment where I forget her name, but she was like, I'm not going to turn off onto the exit. I think she was with she worked at the tattoo parlor, I think, or who that was, but I forget her name, you know, but just things like that, or the gentleman who had to leave
because he was having a baby potentially. And then, obviously he left the venue and then it was a false alarm and she didn't end up having the baby that night.
So I was wondering, John, if you could speak to any one of those situations, you know, kind of that before, during, after those decisions and kind of how you see this event kind of unfolding and being created and, you know, unfortunately, you know, happening.
You break it down very logically and in terms of the before, during, and after. From your audience's perspective, I think maybe the most interesting and the most relevant to their concert going is the middle section. That is the behavior of people when they arrive at a venue, when they go to their seats, how they conduct themselves during the concert. In researching the book and in writing, and even in the years of the book tour afterwards, as I've come to present at different industry functions, like there's a great concert industry group called the Event Safety Alliance. And it brings together all the real gorillas of the big concert industry. I mean, the people who promote and operationally run the multi-day festivals, Bonnaroo and Burning Man and these sort of things, Live Nation, Ticketmaster, people who build the sets, people who transport the sets, the riggers who climb on this stuff to set up these amazing concert stages. I did a presentation literally at one of the biggest set manufacturers for the road shows, and they produce concert staging, and I don't have to tell you guys because you go to so many of them, but for a typical John Bon Jovi concert or Beyonce, we're talking about 40 semi-rigs, 40, packed so efficiently that in one day get assembled, all locked together, all these pieces, get tested, get rigged out. They build their own fly space. They have humans crawling up there. And you have the concert and then they're broken down. And not only are they concerned with the safety of the patrons, as they must be, but they've really got to be concerned with the safety of this army of people who makes it all happen. And one of the fascinating things I've gotten to do is meet with these people and learn how they plan out concerts. I'll come back to more mundane considerations for your concert goers, but just for example, I was shown the safety run book for next year's Bonnaroo. And it was a binder 4 inches thick with covering every topic from weather monitoring to lightning strikes to how do you communicate with all of these people to get them to seek shelter when it's necessary? How do you communicate with them after they've been in shelter for 2 hours that it is all clear? And things like not only weather considerations, and after the Indianapolis State Fair tragedy, which you may have seen video of, that's a big concern, of mm-hmm. course. Fire is always a big concern. Crush is a huge concern. Just how do you manage those people down in the first few rows? How do you protect them from an inevitable crush behind them? Because everybody wants to get closer to the stage. Learning about that has been fascinating. But on a more mundane level, when each of your audience goes to their favorite concert, maybe it's a small venue in their hometown, I hope that after reading about the station fire, the first thing that they do is just look at the overall venue and ask themselves, does this look like a place where safety is a priority? Does it look physically safe? Does it look well maintained as they're going in? Does the staff look neat? Do they look well trained? Do they look confident? And after you're checked in and you find your seat, one of the first things you have to do is find the nearest multiple exits. It definitely won't be the door you came in by, but check it out. And then before you start to drink, before you start to enjoy yourselves, share that information with your friends. Just say, see that door over there? The moment something goes down, whether it's a fire, whether it's a fight, anything, we are out that door, all of us. We don't stop to get our coat. We don't stop to get our drink because, as you mentioned, Chris, it's in that few seconds of decision that can make the difference between being a survivor who reads about this in the paper the next morning and being somebody who never makes it home that night.
Is there one thing that a concert fan could bring for personal safety when they're at an event or concert?
Frankly, their common sense and not get too impaired. I hate to be waggish, but you know, there's a phenomenon that event safety people whom I interviewed for the book talked about, and that is the phenomenon of engagement and how we as concert goers watch an act. And we're invested in it. We're invested monetarily. Concerts cost a lot now. Okay. And we tend to disbelieve the out of the ordinary. We want to believe it's part of the show. And we tend to remain engaged in the entertainment longer than we should if something bad is going down, whether it be crowd panic or fire or fight. And of course, that happened at the station. Many people looked at the fire on the foam behind Great White and thought, at least for a few seconds, that's part of the show. But if you have watched that video that was shot that night, you can see that the mood of the crowd goes from upbeat and ebullient to concerned, to very worried, to horror. Over about a 30-second period. And you have to be one of the first to recognize the danger. And that's why I say, have a good time, but keep your wits about you.
Yeah, one of the, absolutely right. That video, watching that footage, it is eerie watching that transformation happen. And you know, I was putting myself in those situations. We've been in some weird situations, you know, and pinned between pits and in between the bands and the fans. And, you know, as journalists, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like, you know, feel grateful to be out, to be able to make it out of those, but those situations. And it got me thinking, John, I wanted to ask you, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, like how safe do you feel concert fans are at their average show today? Like, you know, the book, you know, was written many years, you know, years ago, and you know, we're curious if, you know, things have changed, and I was wondering, you know, that scale 1 to 10, like how safe do you think concert fans are today? You know, 10 being very safe and 1 not safe.
Well, I think if things were a 5 in 2012, and we're talking now medium size and not A-list venues, mm-hmm. maybe things are more of an 8 now. Fire codes have been tightened up in most states. Mm-hmm. Certainly enforcement has been enhanced in most states. And I meet with state fire marshals associations. I've probably presented in most states in the United States and several in Canada, where I'm presenting to fire marshals and impressing upon them the importance of their job. And it's easy to get jaded and bored with their job. And they do appreciate it. And I think the increased seriousness has raised safety from maybe a 5 to an 8. It will never be perfect. People will always get lazy. Modest venues will always be in a money crunch, and they will cut corners in ways that compromise safety. I can tell you that when you pay the big bucks and you pay your tribute to Live Nation and you go to an A-list venue, you're at your safest. These mm-hmm. major arenas, no crowd control. Mm-hmm. And they appreciate the potential for crush, certainly the potential for fire. When you go to see Kiss or anybody that uses pyro properly, this is unlike at the station. This is pyro where they have pulled a local fire permit. They've shown a show plan to the local fire marshal. They've gotten their permit. It's being shot by a licensed pyrotechnician, as it wasn't here. There are, according to the show plan, people in the wings standing at the ready with fire extinguishers. You may not see them, mm-hmm. but they're there. Sometimes, to satisfy a local fire marshal, the shooters will have to run the whole show plot. They'll have to shoot $5,000 or $10,000 worth of pyro for nothing to have the show permitted. But if I see, you know, Kiss or Aerosmith or anybody use pyro in a major venue, I'm not worried. If I see somebody shooting pyro in a medium size, God help us, low ceiling, older venue, I can't get to the door fast enough. Hmm.
Do you think that, I guess before I ask that question, I mean, there's a, unfortunately, again, like a list of tragedies like this that have happened. I know the station fire was the worst in the United States. And there was one in South America, you know, that had happened. And reading through your book and looking at the history of how these situations have happened, you know, over the years, I mean, do you think that this something like this could happen again in the United States, or do you think that enough work has been done as a result of, you know, your book and these conversations and some of these other venues seeing these tragedies happen? Like, do you think this could happen again?
Sadly, I think it can happen again in a lesser rate venue, mm-hmm. even in the United States. We've seen, as you pointed out, actually, it's called the Kiss Club in Brazil. Mm-hmm. A terrible club fire. Pyro lit off indoors, inadequate exits. I think some 300 people plus may have lost their lives in that. There was, shortly after the station fire, club fire in Russia. One after that, I believe, in Bali, where pyro was shot indoors unwisely, and it was tragic. So, you know, sadly, as humans, we are slow learners. And while there may be immediate interest and attention to detail, we are running into club owners now and even fire marshals who may not be familiar with this. Thankfully, not to this certainly wasn't intended by me, but it's a positive outcome. My book has now become part of the curriculum in most community college fire safety courses and state fire academies, where they're training new firemen, they're training new building inspectors, and people are acutely aware of the event. You know, it's easy to get complacent as a fire inspector. They're usually, if you've ever produced a show, they're the bad guy. They're always the guy telling you, is that curtain fire rated? You're overcrowded this area. Don't put those seats near that exit. They're just the pain in the neck guys. And I remind them that, subject as they may be to political pressures, I mean, I've had people come up to me after presentations and say, I'm the fire marshal in this city. And the other day, the mayor called me and said, meet me at this restaurant that my friend owns because I want you to do your inspection. And he'll go to the restaurant and the mayor will put his arm around the restaurateur and say, this is my good buddy so-and-so. I want you to do a good inspection. You know what that means.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there remain that kind of pressures.
Sure.
But what I tell them is that they have a most unusual job. They have this very important job. And if they do their job really, really well, and they prevent the next station fire, they'll never know. But if they don't do their job well and the next station fire happens on their watch, they'll never be able to forget it. And I think they leave with that message. So in a long-winded answer to your question, there remains some heightened sensitivity to these issues and heightened attention to safety, as there must be.
Yeah. It's good to hear. And one other thing that comes to mind, you know, just in this, you know, with the economic backdrop that we're in, you know, with bands, they need to tour in order to make money, right? We talk a lot about that on the show with fans and artists about, you know, you're no longer making money on the album. You got to tour to like make money, right?
And you have to make, you know, friends and with everybody's the
too. Right, and everybody's needs, you know, so much of people's livelihoods are depending on how much that tour can make, right? Everybody has a stake in how much they're making from that. So in those kind of situations, cost becomes an issue, and then you start kind of prioritizing what you can cut, you know, from that. And I know that was a big part of the story with the venue owners of the station, and I think some of the stuff you mentioned about the, you know, the band as well, and just trying to, you know, get as much, keep the margins as, you know, profitable as possible. Do you think, knowing what people know now, having, you know, read the book, seen that, the talks that you've given,
seen the bigger picture,
that like even in an economic climate now where it's like everybody's trying to make as much money as you can on the actual show, that safety is still, you know, a priority, where they're not going to, you know, if they're going to cut something, it's not going to be, you know, related to making a safe environment. And is that tiered with, you know, the bigger high ticket tours can afford to keep safety, and then the smaller venues, cause they're pinched in a different way. But do you think in the economic climate they're in now, and the impact of touring and, you know, on the bottom line of an artist, is, you know, is safety
first priority
at risk? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think?
In the A-list venues, it remains a high priority. And one of the reasons it does is one of the interested groups, if you will, that participates in the Event Safety Alliance is the insurance industry. And insuring these tours is big business, but there's a big downside if there's a tragedy. And these insurers want to make sure that safety remains a high priority. So once again, if you go to the A-list venues, you can be sure that not only is the promoter interested from a corporate standpoint in safety as a priority, but their insurance carrier is, and they're seeing what that safety book is like. I'll tell you a funny story from the person who was in charge of safety at either Burning Man or Bonnaroo. I said, what are some of the policy things that you discuss in this run book? And he said, well, take for example, if there's lightning within an X mile radius, and we make the announcement that there's a storm front coming through, we ask everybody to shelter either in their cars or whatever. And he said, when we make that announcement, we use the 70-20-10 rule. I said, what's the 70-20-10 rule? And he said, well, 70% of the people are going to hear and understand the announcement the first time, and they'll take appropriate action. Another 20% will turn to those people and say, huh, what was that? And they'll get educated by those people. He said, and the remaining 10% of the people are going to be out there dancing around in the lightning and the thunder, and we let Darwin take care of them. It's, you know, you can only do so much. And after a while, responsibility does fall on the individual.
They have a, how do they know 70-20-10?
He was being waggish.
Oh, I see.
but what he really yeah. meant is that no matter how hard they try, some concert goers will be stupid.
Ah, gotcha.
And so it's safety at these big venues or even modest clubs is, yes, it's mostly their job, but it's partly your job as a patron to have your eyes open and don't get so engaged with the event that you overlook the signs of a problem.
And I think the fans need to be cautious when they, you know, I'm seeing a lot, an uptick. I get a lot of emails and, you know, I'm looking on TikTok or Facebook and come to the secret show, or we're going to show up in this town and we're just going to do a free pop-up show. Or maybe kind of an up and coming star decides they're going to, you know, do a show at somebody's house, and the person has opened up their house to the show. I'm just seeing a lot of that. And just based on what you're talking about, reading your book, I'm like, that is just not a good idea. You know, it might be good for the fans because it's that it's that up and close, intimate experience. But when you look at all of the parts, the moving parts to a festival or even a small show, you know, having to have the right security, making sure even, you know, that everybody is watched and checked during the show because there could be a medical emergency, making sure the band is happy, you know, making sure there's enough food and the food is prepared right if they have food at the venue and the drinks are prepared right. I just hearing you talk, I'm thinking like all these invites that I've gotten, like I'm just surprised we're not seeing more of that at these pop-up concerts.
You make a great point, Colleen. Those type of events present particular hazards because odds are they have not pulled permits, they don't have a fire inspection, they're not designed to be a venue that people can exit quickly. You saw the tragic event in California with, was it called the Ghost Ship venue there in the San Francisco?
Yes. Area, yes.
I believe, or Oakland. And there was a place that was being used for pop-up concerts and stuff like that. And it never should have been a place of public assembly. It was a terrible fire trap. So yeah, you're absolutely right that those type of things present unique hazards. And very shortly after the book came out, I happened to be in Oregon, and I was in a club in kind of a backwater. And after we made our entrance, things were kind of hopping that night. There wasn't any name group or anything like that. It's just a very popular watering hole. And it was kind of a labyrinth of rooms. And by the time I and my friends got to the back room where they wanted to go, I realized that there is no way I could get out of here in a hurry if I had to. And I said goodbye to everyone, and I made my way out. That was within 5 minutes of entering there and looking around. It's funny. Young people who go to concerts, like most young people, think they're immortal and invincible, and nothing can happen to them. And I've had people come up to me and say, you know, I saw your presentation, I read your book, and you know, those people have been drinking, and I'm smarter, I'm faster, I'm stronger. No one's keeping me in a situation like that. If I want to get out, I'm getting out. And I show them photos of the actual density within the floor plan of the people packed into the Station nightclub. And I said, you know, if you are right there in the middle of that crowd, and this is true for many venues, it doesn't matter how sober you are, smart you are, strong you are. If you're the first to notice a problem and you want to make for the exit, you're at the mercy of the person in front of you, behind you, to your right, and to your left. And they realize that survivability, if people as a group do not act wisely, and if promoters and owners don't act wisely, turns on one thing alone, and that is luck of location. If you're near an exit, you stand a chance. If you're not, you don't. So, you know, don't be too confident, young person, when you go to one of these pop-up things at an unsuitable venue. You're at the mercy of all the people around you.
And you're reminding me of, you know, because we're from Chicago, so that E2, I remember seeing that on the news, and the video, the picture they kept showing was people just smashed in the front. And it was like, it's so traumatizing for me just seeing it on the nightly news, that I think I always in my head knew it had nothing to do with necessarily the substance use, or, you know, how rowdy the club with the people were. It was getting out, you know, it's just the idea of getting out and getting a mass amount of people out safely that really becomes the problem, I think, at the end of the day. And that's a lot of what you talked about in this book. So yeah, you know, I just remember that as a kid, and just it still traumatizes me thinking that, you know, these people tried to get out. And that was what kept him back, really, was just so many people trying to get through a small door, and not, people were just not prepared as far as security or the venue to make that happen. And that seems to be the easiest thing you could do as far as changing a venue, is adding a door, adding a couple doors potentially. I mean, I know that's a security issue, but I mean, obviously you have to look at locking it, but maybe adding extra exits would be just a simple solution. For some.
Yeah. I've got to ask, Colleen, when you were in Chicago, had you been to E2?
No, I hadn't. No, I hadn't actually been to that club particularly. We had went to quite a few clubs though in Chicago, and just because of everybody stacked on top of each other, a lot of the clubs were double deckers, or I went to one club that was three parts. And you were going up upstairs to each part, and the top one was actually like an attic type thing. And they actually had a show on each level. And I'm just thinking, like, lucky, but I mean, there's just so much that could have happened. And I remember going to the top floor and loving it because there was only so many people up there. I think it's because so many people were scared to. I mean, because there's probably like two sets of stairs for each level, and they had like a different type of band or a different type of genre music playing. And I mean, they were full, that club, I would think probably from Thursday to Sunday, they were full, and there was never any issues. The club was called Excalibur, and I remember it was kind of near Michigan Avenue. Just looking back now, I'm thinking, like, what the heck? I mean, was I thinking? Cavernous, I didn't even care about the idea of safety, which, you know, now doing the podcast, I'm just, you know, looking back, I'm thinking, yeah, I was that naive kid, you know, that didn't or young adult, I should say, that just didn't look at the bigger picture. And I hope that, you know, some of our fans that are younger get a chance to listen to this, because there are things that maybe you just don't think of walking in. You're thinking of the excitement of the show. But if you walk in and there's something that you don't see that's right, you know, think, don't worry about the money at that point. At some point you can probably fight that and call the owner and say, I walked in, I didn't like it. I mean, I don't know how that procedure would work. They might get denied, you know, return of money, but maybe there's a way they could go in and just say, like, I went in, I saw these things, I wasn't, you know, happy about that. I was concerned, and write a letter to the owner. I mean, some of these club owners are really amazing. I met some of the club owners, and the Metro club owner, he's very personal to the media, because we had known him, because we had gone and out, and he would walk around his club, the Metro, and really look at the fans, the security. He knew some of the regular attendees. He would walk up to the bar, and he wouldn't sit at the bar. He would walk around and make sure everyone was served. And Shanahan was his last name. So, Metro. You know, some of these owners are really on top of it. Obviously in this case, the station, the owners were not. Now, I don't know about the original owners, but I know the most recent ones, when that happened, when the fire happened, they were not. And so I'd like to get into that a little bit. Do you feel like justice was served for the families and the victims?
Well, it's one of the things that people in the state had a hard time coming to grips with was the very few criminal indictments that issued from this event. As you know, 100 people lost their lives, and people expected heads to roll. As it turned out, only 3 indictments issued from this tragedy. And those were the 2 brothers who owned the club and the road manager for Great White, who physically connected up the pyro. Missing from those indicted were the fire marshal who overlooked the flammable foam on the walls, and of course, Jack Russell of Great White. It was really his alter ego band at that point anyway, and it was his decision to use the illegal pyro. So his road manager took the fall for him, if you will. So people were not pleased with that outcome. And then the 2 brothers who owned the club and allowed it to be overcrowded and allowed, even encouraged, illegal pyro and put this flammable substance up on the walls. They both pleaded guilty to 100 counts of manslaughter. And one of them served 27 months in a minimum security facility. And the other, pleading guilty to the same charges, served no jail time, just community service. So people thought that, at least from a criminal standpoint, people who should have been charged weren't charged, and those who were got off remarkably light.
Why do you think that happened? Like, why do you think that was the response like that?
Some would call it the Rhode Island shuffle. That kind of, it's who you know, but being a little more sophisticated in the law, practicing for 40 years, I tried to explain to people that sentencing in criminal offenses has to turn on the degree of culpability, real fault. And as tragic as this event was, the one thing that you got to accept, even the families of the victims has to accept, is that no one intended for this to happen. People may have been stunningly careless. They may have been somewhat greedy in decisions they made, but no one intended that one person, let alone 100 persons, would lose their lives. And even the judge, in doing the sentencing here, had to explain that to the public, that given the degree of culpability, what we call mens rea or evil mind in the law, which really just wasn't there. It was just stunning, callous carelessness. That had to factor into the sentences. So knowing the law better, I'm not as offended by the length of the sentences. given the degree of culpability, but I can certainly understand how members of the station fire community remain hurt and offended.
Do you think the way that this was ruled and, you know, the impact of your book and looking back now on the impact that this has had on the fans, that this would change and create, is there any like legal precedence, you know, that would say, hey, if this happened again, I hope it doesn't, right? But as far as like, should it happen again, that you'd expect the fans to get, that were impacted by this, to get more, again, we could probably debate like the word justice, like what that means, because it's human life, right? But I mean, in this situation, obviously it was like, is that what you call justice and for what was happening? But based off of what you just described, and now looking back on it, now that time has passed and, you know, there's documentation and, you know, like, do you think a judge would look at it differently now, going, even though there wasn't intent, but there was clearly some things, decisions that were made that led to this, that would change the legal ruling in the future? Should this?
I don't think so from a criminal standpoint. Okay, because the judge's sentencing decisions were certainly, and these were plea agreements that the judge accepted, they were reasonable and they would remain reasonable today. I think what has changed, though, is the fire codes, okay? And you said, well, I hope it doesn't happen. What has changed is the law and the enforcement that will make it less likely to happen. I'll never be the person that says, oh, it couldn't happen here again. But the fire law has been changed not only in Rhode Island, but in many states as a result of the Station Nightclub fire. Specifically in Rhode Island, the threshold at which it's required that a place of public assembly be sprinklered has been lowered. The Station Nightclub was not a sprinklered venue. Had it been, there probably would have been no loss of life, perhaps some injuries, but the fire would have been knocked down very quickly, and maybe there would have been crowd injuries or smoke injuries, but it would have been a completely different result. But the venue was what was called grandfathered into the fire code, because when it was built, you didn't require sprinklers. Now, when I talk about enforcement, it would be tightened up today, because even back then in the fire code, there was a provision that while you may be grandfathered in, if there has been a so-called change of use and occupancy since the fire code was enacted, you don't get grandfathered in. You've got to put sprinklers in. And God knows, in this venue, when it went from a restaurant seating 50 people to a bar seating 150 to a rundown concert venue that they crammed over 400 people into, that's a change of use or occupancy. And that should have triggered the requirement by the fire marshal to require that the venue be sprinklered. And it didn't. I don't think we're going to see that kind of flouting of the fire code going forward.
And I fell in love with all of the fans, just the way that you wrote it. And then I watched the documentary. I just fell in love with their families and just their excitement. You know, the whole town almost is like getting ready. It kind of reminded me of the circus coming to town, kind of like this concert, this band was coming to town. Everybody was excited about it. You know, people were trying to get off work early. Families knew all of their family members that were there. Obviously there's a memorial park that I saw in the movie that they have for the victims. What does it feel like as far as the grief of the community and where they are mentally? Because obviously there was, you said everybody knows everybody in these small towns. And I get the sense that everybody was affected, experiencing one of their family members being there, or a loved one losing someone, and then having to obviously help them through that grief and talk with them. So how is it now being there? I mean, are people still talking about the impact that the station fire has had on the community?
You're absolutely right that this had a widespread effect in our tiny state. It's faded somewhat in people's memories, but thanks in part to that lovely memorial park that you referred to, that's you see in the documentary, and you can go online and look at it. That was many years in the making, but it really brought together a lot of groups and a lot of persons to bring it about. For the longest time, the owner of the real estate, the fellow that had leased out the club to then the owners, was very resistant to anything appropriate happening there. I think he thought that he could eventually build a McDonald's on it and people would not bother about it. But it became clear with all of the makeshift memorials there over the years that this was regarded as kind of sacred ground by people in our small state. And he was approached rather than in a hostile way, because he was one of the defendants in the civil suits, more in a conciliatory way of, don't you want to do the right thing here? And I think he realized that as a practical matter, nobody wanted to build a McDonald's on this site. Nobody wanted to be that businessman. So he gave the land to the nonprofit corporation that was established to build the memorial. And, you know, enjoyed some tax benefits from that, but still, he finally did the right thing many years after the fire. And money was raised, and through money raised and volunteer labor, a great memorial to all the 100 victims was constructed. You can visit there, and it's a sacred ground, but much more appropriately done now.
Yeah, just the idea that, you know, again, so unfortunate that happened, but, you know, in the aftermath that ground is considered sacred. It's just, it's really special. And, you know, we, obviously us and other concert fans consider the concert experience itself often to be a sacred experience in and of itself, you know, and to have, you know, all what happened at the station fire, you know, occur and have at least, you know, some, again, it's you know, we all know grief is not, it doesn't have a beginning. Well, it has a beginning, but it doesn't have an end, you know, many times, you know, but memorializing things and having a place to kind of attach to grief to, and, you know, is a great time, a place to heal, right? So it's like allowing the fans to do that, I think was really important to hear that is considered a sacred area, you know, sacred ground, because of what happened, but also it's where concert, you know, happened, and, you know, a lot of things obviously happened at that moment. So that's good to, hear, you know, as far
as you point out,
you know,
grief is not a linear process. And mm-hmm. as you know, from your work, communal activity, whether it be concert going or worship or appreciation of music, is more powerful for the fact that large community is doing it. And we can say what we will about large crowds gathering together and their danger, but there's power and there's emotion in that experience. Having a fitting memorial allows people to have a gathering place. So the sense of community that, in a sense, brought people to this tragic location continues to bring their survivors together at the location.
Yeah, it's great. And again, John, thank you for talking about the experience of the book. And we wanted to switch gears a little bit and go into some of your experiences. And you had answered some of our, well, actually all, you know, all of it, but yeah, you had some really, really interesting and memorable moments that you had shared as a concert fan yourself. So if you don't mind, we'd like to dive into those for a bit and get into your five all-time favorite shows. And you also answered one question very interestingly, given the topic of the book and you know, your work. So we'll get into that. But the first one, your five all-time favorite shows, you listed seeing the Four Seasons while you were in high school. Tell
That's
us.
Right.
Take us back to that moment. Why is that your number one moment?
Well, I think because this is going to sound hackneyed, but because it was my first. It's like women. What can I say? You know? I was in high school, and in the community I grew up in had a small college, and the Four Seasons with Frankie Valli had an appearance there. And it was in the beginning. I'm kind of a geezer. So we're talking about 1965, maybe. So, you know, when I was in high school, that was a big deal. Then I saw at my college, the Young Rascals, and I thought they put on a hell of a show. You know, we were fortunate to have Janis Joplin and some heavyweights at spring weekend at Brown, where I went. So all those were great. In recent years, I've got to say, I'll admit with some embarrassment that I'm a Broadway geek. So my wife and I, who both have theater experience, tend to go to a lot of Broadway shows in New York. But every once in a while, I'll go to a big venue rock concert. And sorry, but I like Aerosmith. Okay, I've been to a number of their concerts.
Yeah,
Second row, right by Steven Tyler's teleprompter. So I know the set list coming up. From having looked at the teleprompter, I see just how vapid all the lyrics are, but I still like it.
So I saw, you listed Huey Lewis in the News multiple times and Aerosmith multiple times.
Yeah.
So why do you keep going back to seeing Huey Lewis and Aerosmith? What was it about that? Was it who you were with? Was it, you know, the music? Like what made you want to fork over cash, hard-earned cash, over and over again to see those bands, right? Like what was it, and why do those stand out as your top concert? What was that experience like for you?
Particularly for Huey Lewis, I had seen him in large venues, and then one summer he was doing kind of a pop-up tour as a group called the Sports Section. They didn't even call it Huey Lewis and the News. And they would show up at these little venues, and you'd get word of it by word of mouth kind of thing. Probably in retrospect, not the safest. But one of those concerts, I was within 5 feet of him. Sadly, Huey's suffered hearing loss now, and he's done. But he put on, and always did, a high energy show. And just, you know, people sniff at Huey Lewis as oh, this is a highfalutin bar band. Well, maybe it is, but it's some pretty high energy, fun shows. And we liked it.
Well, I was a big fan of Huey Lewis in the News. I mean, soundtrack to one of my favorite movies of all time, you know, Back to the Future. I mean, Power of Love, you know, how could you, you know, The Heart of Rock and Roll. I mean, those are some iconic, pop songs of all time, I think that they so I totally agree. We saw him, right? Saw him live, but we did. We saw him in Chicago, this venue called Ravinia, you know. I could see why you would want to do that. Now looking back at those shows, in writing the book The Killer Show, like were there things about those shows that stood out to you, you know, that if you were to go back in those moments, and you know, do you think you would experience the show differently knowing what you know now about, you know, having written the book? Would you, you know, experience Huey Lewis and the News differently, or Four Seasons, or Aerosmith? Like, what would those experiences change for you at all?
I absolutely would have looked at the experience at the small pop-up for what was dubbed the Sports Section, which was really Huey Lewis and the News. In retrospect, it was pretty unsafe. And I don't know if I would have had the discipline at the time, because I wasn't as attuned to those things before the station fire. The others were in major venues. So I'm not as concerned. I'd feel just as safe, frankly. In major, we have kind of semi-covered huge outdoor venues and stuff, aside from possible crowd rush problems that they see too pretty well, those are safe venues.
No big changes except for the pop-up situation.
Pretty much.
No, that makes sense. I think that was what you had guided Colleen on that suggestion. Those pop-up situations can be kind of crazy.
I'm curious how the Janis Joplin show was. I've heard that some of the shows were amazing and others were, you know, she was intoxicated and not so, I don't know, she wasn't too with it. So how was your experience with her?
It was really pretty good. It was in a hockey rink. So at least acoustically, it certainly wasn't the best concert venue. But as spring weekend partygoers, we probably weren't too concerned with that. I will tell you that Janis came back to our fraternity house with one of my fraternity brothers and partied one-on-one. So that was pretty impressive.
Showed him a good time.
Oh. So his after concert experience was pretty good.
Yes.
Is what you're saying.
When we go offline, I can tell you about the after party experience.
Sure. Yeah, that'll be a bonus episode that we won't publish after Live Fix after recording. So yeah, you saw the your first concert, which we just talked about at Drew University. You answered one question that we asked, and what do you think is the most important element of a live show? And you checked the band. One of the sections that you could have checked was the venue. Tell us why you picked the band, because it would be very interesting. I would expect you to pick the venue just because of your work and obviously the book and that. But tell me, and if you want to rethink your selection, we can have, you know, we'll give you a pass. But why did you pick the band?
I suppose the mature lawyer author should have picked the safety of the venue. In truth, sure. why do we put our money down to go out? We do it because we want to join the community of people that are energized by this performer and feel, artificial as it may be, a sense of connection to that performer. After you've seen Huey Lewis or Steven Tyler enough times and you know exactly what their set order is going to be, you convince yourself that you have some kind of connection to them. And if you're in row two with Steven Tyler, you almost do. So it's still the band. It's still why we go, but we have to keep our heads about us and stay safe.
And one of the questions you answer, living or dead, if you could pick an artist or band to see live, who would it be? And you said the Beatles. Which, yes, we love the Beatles here. So what part of the Beatles is, I guess, inspiring you or drawing you in? Like, obviously you didn't see them live.
Did you see them live or you didn't?
I did not see them live, but you got to understand, I was a freshman in high school at the beginning of the British invasion, 1964. Mm. And when the Beatles arrived in New York for their first tour, I was a freshman. So you can imagine how they were the soundtrack of my adolescence. So once a band occupies that central position, and certainly I didn't know how pervasive and what legs their catalog would have over decades and generations, I lucked into having the right band to be the soundtrack of my adolescence.
And who was your favorite Beatle and why?
Got to be Paul McCartney because he was engaging, but I got to say Ringo Starr knows that he's the luckiest man in the world and he knew it back then. So, but that's pretty endearing.
What stopped you from, did you have any opportunities to see the Beatles that you could have gone and seen them? Because we have on a previous episode, we talked with the lady who wrote a book about how she kind of snuck in, you know, and this fictional accounts and told really crazy stories about, you know, wanting to get into the Beatles because you couldn't, or, you know, just that. But did you have any opportunities that maybe you wish you would have taken up, or like, or did you never ever even have an opportunity to go see the Beatles live?
Not really. Even though, you know, I was fairly near New York, I was really too young to do anything wild and crazy. And I can't imagine asking my parents to let me do that or foot the bill. So no, I can't say it. I almost went and saw the Beatles. I just bought every album and played them to death with pleasure.
And was there a lot of live music attending at your house, or was it mostly putting records on when you were growing up?
As far as pop stuff, it was mostly putting records on. As I say, I was kind of a theater geek, so I was in, you know, performing arts in high school and college. So you're doing much more traditional Great American Songbook, Broadway catalog type stuff. But still enjoying pop stuff. I mean, Sgt. Pepper's was the album of my senior year, and talk about playing it to death and memorizing every measure. Just great stuff.
That's a great one. And what similarities do you see between, you know, live theater and live music? How do you see those playing to each other? Because you see an artist like David Bowie, or, you know, some of the other artists who really are theatrical when they're performing, you know,
Lady Gaga.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be a great performer, and, you know, it just seems that is essential when you're a live music performer, that you have to tap into everything that a theater performer does in a play or in a performance, that you have to do that in a live music experience, really, to make that experience really, you know, emotive and memorable for the fans. So what analogies and, you know, similarities do you see between live theater and live music?
Well, in recent years, things have changed with overproduction and auto-tune, and things where I kind of cynically say that one does not have to be a mega talent in order to fill a stadium and put on an otherwise impressive show. Back in the day, and I'm going to sound like an old guy, particularly in the traditional theater, you had to be able to project over a pit orchestra. Even the cast was not body mic'd as they are on Broadway now. But there are still similarities. There's the sense of community among the audience, and there's the true affection between the audience and the live people on stage who are close enough to appreciate you, the audience's presence. I'll never forget, as I was still in high school, when the Bob Fosse choreographed musical Pippin was very popular on Broadway. And I went to see it. Actually, no, it was at the beginning of my working years, right out of college. Saw Pippin because I was working in New York, and I was in row two. And during the curtain call, when the marvelous cast took their bows, I saw one cast member mouth to the other, "Great house," or "great audience." And I realized that we're on our feet cheering for them. And there was a connection. They appreciated us almost as much as we appreciated them. And that's going to be true, I think, whether it's a rock concert or a traditional theater concert, a little more intimate in the latter, but still a sense of community going both ways.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I'm sure with your background, you know, in the book, you know, in your work and your love for live theater, that is just something that you can go to a show and you can make it even more memorable for you when you see all that happening. And John, it's been fantastic having you here. We're so appreciative.
We learned so, you know, much, and I can't wait for our listeners to listen and just learn all these safety tips, and also learn that, you know, people like you are keeping an eye out of what, you know, what's going on in these venues and these big productions. They're actually have an expert like you really telling them make sure you look at this, make sure you look at this. And so thank you for doing that.
Well, thanks, guys. It's a real pleasure. And thank you for looking into the book and the documentary so well.
Live Fix Podcast is a production of Live Fix Media and is produced by Chris and Colleen Catania. Hey, we know every concert fan has a live music story to share, and we'd love to share yours in a future episode. So head on over to livefixpodcast.com and click on Share Your Story. We look forward to hearing from you. Like what you heard? Did you get inspired by the stories of your fellow concert fans? Then help support Live Fix Podcast by subscribing and sharing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We appreciate your support, and thanks for listening.